his lips moving. His voice was barely audible, something less than a whisper. I leaned down and put my ear to his lips. He was mumbling, fading in and out of lucidity, shifting between English and Polish. "I don't understand," I whispered. I repeated his name until his eyes seemed to focus on me, and then he drew a sharp breath and said, quietly but clearly, "Go to the island, Jacob. Here, it's not safe." It was the old paranoia. I squeezed his hand and assured him we were fine. He was going to be fine. That was twice in one day that I'd lied to him. I asked him what happened, what animal had hurt him, but he wasn't listening. "Go to the island," he repeated. "You'll be safe there. Promise me." "I will. I promise." What else could I say? "I thought I could protect you," he said. "I should have told you a long time ago." I could see the life going out of him.
"Told me what?"
I said, choking back tears.
"There's no time," he whispered.
Then he raised his head off the ground, trembling with effort, and breathed into my ear.
"Find the bird in the loop on the other side of the old man's grave. September 3rd, 1940.
I nodded, but he could see that I didn't understand. With his last bit of strength, he added,
"Emerson, the letter. Tell them what happened, Jacob."
With that, he sank back, spent and fading. I told him I loved him. And then he seemed to disappear into himself, his gaze drifting past me to the sky, bristling now with stars. A moment later, Ricky crashed out of the underbrush. He saw the old man limp in my arms and fell back a step.
"Oh, man. Oh, Jesus. Oh, Jesus,"
he said, rubbing his face with his hands. And as he babbled about finding a pulse and calling the cops and did you see anything in the woods, the strangest feeling came over me. I let go of my grandfather's body and stood up, every nerve ending tingling with an instinct I didn't know I had. There was something in the woods, all right. I could feel it. There was no moon and no movement in the underbrush but our own. And yet somehow, I knew just when to raise my flashlight and just where to aim it. And for an instant, in that narrow cut of light, I saw a face that seemed to have been transplanted directly from the nightmares of my childhood. It stared back with eyes that swam in dark liquid, furrowed trenches of carbon black flesh loose on its hunched frame, its mouth hinged open grotesquely so that a mass of long, eel-like tongues could wriggle out. I shouted something, and then it twisted and was gone, shaking the brush and drawing Ricky's attention. He raised his .22 and fired, pap, 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 saying, "What was that? What the hell was that?" But he hadn't seen it, and I couldn't speak to tell him, frozen in place as I was, my dying flashlight flickering over the blank woods. And then I must have blacked out because he was saying, "Jacob, Jake, hey, Ed, are you okay or what?" And that's the last thing I remember. Chapter 2. I spent the months following my grandfather's death cycling through a purgatory of beige waiting rooms and anonymous offices, analyzed and interviewed, talked about just out of earshot, nodding when spoken to, repeating myself, the object of 1,000 pitying glances and knitted brows. My parents treated me like a breakable heirloom, afraid to fight or fret in front of me lest I shatter. I was plagued by wake-up screaming nightmares so bad that I had to wear a mouth guard to keep from grinding my teeth into nubs as I slept. I couldn't close my eyes without seeing it, that tentacle mouth horror in the woods. I was convinced it had killed my grandfather and that it would soon return for me. Sometimes, that sick, panicky feeling would flood over me like it did that night, and I'd be sure that nearby, lurking in a stand of dark trees, beyond the next car in a parking lot, behind the garage where I kept my bike, it was waiting. My solution was to stop leaving the house. For weeks, I refused even to venture into the driveway to collect the morning paper. I slept in a tangle of blankets on the laundry room floor, the only part of the house with no windows and also a door that locked from the inside. That's where I spent the day of my grandfather's funeral, sitting on the dryer with my laptop, trying to lose myself in online games. I blame myself for what happened. If only I'd believed him, was my endless refrain. But I hadn't believed him, and neither had anyone else. And now I knew how he must have felt, because no one believed me either. My version of the events sounded perfectly rational until I was forced to say the words aloud. And then it sounded insane, particularly on the day I had to say them to the police officer who came to our house. I told him everything that had happened, even about the creature, as he sat nodding across the kitchen table, writing nothing in a spiral notebook. When I finished, all he said was, "Great, thanks," and then turned to my parents and asked if I'd been to see anyone, as if I wouldn't know what that meant. I told him I had another statement to make and then held up my middle finger and walked out. My parents yelled at me for the first time in weeks. It was kind of a relief, actually, that old, sweet sound. I yelled some ugly things back, that they were glad Grandpa Portman was dead, that I was the only one who'd really loved him. The cop and my parents talked in the driveway for a while, and then the cop drove off, only to come back an hour later with a man who introduced himself as a sketch artist. He'd brought a big drawing pad and asked me to describe the creature again, and as I did, he sketched it, stopping occasionally to ask for clarifications. "How many eyes did it have?" "Two." "Gotcha," he said, as if monsters were a perfectly normal thing for a police sketch artist to be drawing. As an attempt to placate me, it was pretty transparent. The biggest giveaway was when he tried to give me the finished sketch. "Don't you need this for your files or something?" I asked him. He exchanged raised eyebrows with the cop. "Of course. What was I thinking?" It was totally insulting. Even my best and only friend Ricky didn't believe me, and he'd been there. He swore up and down that he hadn't seen any creature in the woods that night, even though I'd shine my flashlight right at it, which is just what he told the cops. He'd heard barking, though. We both had. So it wasn't a huge surprise when the police concluded that a pack of feral dogs had killed my grandfather. Apparently, they'd been spotted elsewhere and had taken bites out of a woman who'd been walking in Century Woods the week before. All at night, mind you. "Which is exactly when the creatures are hardest to see," I said. But Ricky just shook his head and muttered something about me needing a brain shrinker. "You mean head shrinker," I replied. "And thanks a lot. It's great to have such supportive friends." We were sitting on my roof deck watching the sunset over the gulf, Ricky coiled like a spring in an unreasonably expensive Adirondack chair my parents had brought back from a trip to Amish country, his legs folded beneath him and arms crossed tight, chain-smoking cigarettes with a kind of grim determination. He always seemed vaguely uncomfortable at my house, but I could tell by the way his eyes slid off me whenever he looked in my direction that now it wasn't my parents' wealth that was making him uneasy, but me. "Whatever, I'm just being straight with you," he said. "Keep talking about monsters, and they're going to put you away. Then you really will be special ed." "Don't call me that." He flicked away his cigarette and spat a huge glistening wad over the railing. "Were you just smoking and chewing tobacco at the same time?" "What are you, my mom? Do I look like I blow truckers for food stamps?" Ricky was a connoisseur of your mom jokes, but this was apparently more than he could take. He sprang out of the chair and shoved me so hard I almost fell off the roof. I yelled at him to get out, but he was already going. It was months before I'd see him again. So much for having friends. Eventually, my parents did take me to a brain shrinker, a quiet, olive-skinned man named Dr. Gullen. I didn't put up a fight. I knew I needed help. I thought I'd be a tough case, but Dr. Gullen made surprisingly quick work of me. The calm, affectless way he explained things was almost hypnotizing, and within two sessions, he'd convinced me that the creature had been nothing more than the product of my overheated imagination, that the trauma of my grandfather's death had made me see something that wasn't really there. It was Grandpa Portman's stories that had planted the creature in my mind to begin with, Dr. Gullen explained, so it only made sense that, kneeling there with his body in my arms and reeling from the worst shock of my young life, I had conjured up my grandfather's own boogeyman. There was even a name for it, acute stress reaction. I don't see anything cute about it, my mother said when she heard my shiny new diagnosis. Her joke didn't bother me, though. Almost anything sounded better than crazy. Just because I no longer believed the monsters were real didn't mean I was better, though. I still suffered from nightmares. I was twitchy and paranoid, bad enough at interacting with other people that my parents hired a tutor so that I only had to go to school on days I felt up to it. They also, finally, let me quit Smart Aid. Feeling better became my new job. Pretty soon, I was determined to be fired from this one, too. Once the small matter of my temporary madness had been cleared up, Dr. Golan's function seemed mainly to consist of writing prescriptions. Still having nightmares? I've got something for that. Panic attack on the school bus? This should do the trick. Can't sleep? Let's up the dosage. All those pills were making me fat and stupid, and I was still miserable, getting only 3 or 4 hours of sleep a night. That's why I started lying to Dr. Gullen. I pretended to be fine when anyone who looked at me could see the bags under my eyes and the way I jumped like a nervous cat at sudden noises. 1 week, I faked an entire dream journal, making my dream sound bland and simple, the way a normal person should be. One dream was about going to the dentist, and another I was flying. 2 nights in a row, I told him I dreamed I was naked in school. Then he stopped me. What about the creatures? I shrugged. No sign of them. Guess that means I'm getting better, huh? Dr. Gullen tapped his pen for a moment and then wrote something down. I hope you're not just telling me what you think I want to hear. Of course not, I said, my gaze skirting the framed degrees on his wall, all attesting to his expertness in various subdisciplines of psychology, including, I'm sure, how to tell when an acutely stressed teenager is lying to you. Let's be real for a minute. He set down his pen. You're telling me you didn't have the dream even 1 night this week? I'd always been a terrible liar. Rather than humiliate myself, I copped to it. Well, I muttered, maybe one. The truth was that I'd had the dream every night that week, with minor variations. It always went like this. I'm crouched in the corner of my grandfather's bedroom, amber dusk light retreating from the windows, pointing a pink plastic BB rifle at the door. An enormous glowing vending machine looms where the bed should be, filled not with candy, but rows of razor-sharp tactical knives and armor-piercing pistols. My grandfather's there in an old British Army uniform, feeding the machine dollar bills, but it takes a lot to buy a gun, and we're running out of time. Finally, a shiny .45 spins toward the glass, but before it falls, it gets stuck. He swears in Yiddish, kicks the machine, then kneels down and reaches inside to try and grab it, but his arm gets caught. That's when they come, their long black tongues slithering up outside of the glass, looking for a way in. I point the BB gun at them and pull the trigger, but nothing happens. Meanwhile, Grandpa Portman is shouting like a crazy person. Find the bird! Find the loop! Yaakov Vai, don't you understand? You're goddamn stupid Yotzi! And then the windows shatter and glass rains in and the black tongues are all over us. And that's generally when I wake up in a puddle of sweat, my heart doing hurdles and my stomach tied in knots. Even though the dream was always the same, and we'd been over it 100 times, Dr. Golan still made me describe it in every session. It's like he was cross-examining my subconscious, looking for some clue he might have missed the 99th time around. And in the dream, what's your grandfather saying? The same stuff as always, I said, about the bird and the loop and the grave. His last words. I nodded. Dr. Golan tented his fingers and pressed them to his chin, the very picture of a thoughtful brain shrinker. Any new ideas about what they might mean? Yeah, Jack and shit. Come on, you don't mean that. I wanted to act like I didn't care about the last words, but I did. They'd been eating away at me almost as much as the nightmares. I felt like I owed it to my grandfather not to dismiss the last thing he said to anyone in the world as delusional nonsense, and Dr. Golan was convinced that understanding them might help purge my awful dreams, so I tried. Some of what Grandpa Portman had said made sense, like the thing about wanting me to go to the island. He was worried that the monsters would come after me and thought the island was the only place I could escape them, like he had as a kid. After that, he'd said, I should've told you. But because there was no time to tell me whatever it was he should've told me, I wondered if he hadn't done the next best thing and left a trail of breadcrumbs leading to someone who could tell me, someone who knew his secret. I figured that's what all the cryptic-sounding stuff about the loop and the grave and the letter was. For a while, I thought the loop could be a street in Circle Village, a neighborhood that was nothing but looping cul-de-sacs, and that Emerson might be a person my grandfather had sent letters to, an old war buddy he'd kept in touch with or something. Maybe this Emerson lived in Circle Village, in one of its loops, by a graveyard, and one of the letters he'd kept was dated September 3rd, 1940, and that was the one I needed to read. I knew it sounded crazy, but crazier things have turned out to be true. So after hitting dead ends online, I went to the Circle Village Community Center, where the old folks gather to play shuffleboard and discuss their most recent surgeries, to ask where the graveyard was and whether anyone knew a Mr. Emerson. They looked at me like I had a second head growing out of my neck, baffled that a teenaged person was speaking to them. There was no graveyard in Circle Village, and no one in the neighborhood named Emerson, and no street called Loop Drive, or Loop Avenue, or Loop anything. It was a complete bust. Still, Dr. Golan wouldn't let me quit. He suggested I look into Ralph Waldo Emerson, a supposedly famous old poet. Emerson wrote his fair share of letters, he said. Maybe that's what your grandfather was referring to. It seemed like a shot in the dark, but just to get Golan off my back, one afternoon I had my dad drop me at the library so I could check it out. I quickly discovered that Ralph Waldo Emerson had indeed written lots of letters that had been published. For about 3 minutes, I got really excited, like I was close to a breakthrough, and then two things became apparent. First, that Ralph Waldo Emerson had lived and died in the 1800s, and therefore could not have written any letters dated September 3, 1940, and second, that his writing was so dense and arcane that it couldn't possibly have held the slightest interest for my grandfather, who wasn't exactly an avid reader. I discovered Emerson's soporific qualities the hard way, by falling asleep with my face in the book, drooling all over an essay called Self-Reliance, and having the vending machine dream for the sixth time that week. I woke up screaming and was unceremoniously ejected from the library, cursing Dr. Golan and his stupid theories all the while. The last straw came a few days later, when my family decided it was time to sell Grandpa Portman's house. Before prospective buyers could be allowed inside, though, the place